Today's podcast is sponsored by the people at Aura.com. Now, Aura offers identity theft protection, fraud monitoring, a VPN, password management, and antivirus software all in one easy-to-use app. This means that if your online accounts or passwords are leaked online, you'll be alerted quickly, which means that you can be secure from hackers, scammers, and noisy advertising companies. The narcissists are everywhere. Literally, a friend of mine signed up and Aura found his passwords 9 times on the dark web. So go to Aura.com/Dr. Carter. That's Aura.com/Dr. Carter. And use my link and you'll receive a free 14-day trial. And if you continue, then you'll be able to save an additional 40% off all plans. So thanks to the people at Aura.com for sponsoring this episode.
Welcome to this week's episode of the Surviving Narcissism Podcast. I'm Michaela, the program director, and I would like to start this episode with a quick introduction. For those of you not familiar with surviving narcissism, it is the product of many years of work done by Dr. Les Carter. Dr. Carter is a best-selling author and therapist with more than 40 years of experience, specializing in anger management and narcissistic personality disorder. This week, Dr. C's topic is Fierce Love as an Alternative to Narcissism, featuring Dr. Jackie Lewis.
Well, hello, Team Healthy, and I'm so pleased to have you here with me today, and boy, are we in for a great conversation. For quite some time now, I've been following Dr. Jackie Lewis, and actually, some of you know that I am a huge fan of Richard Rohr, Father Richard Rohr, who's written Falling Upward and Immortal Diamond, and then he's had Jackie Lewis on some of his podcasts and his written materials. And also, I'm so pleased that Jackie, by way of that, was introduced to me there. And so now we have her here on my podcast. And so from chilly New York City, Jackie, first, I'm so pleased to say thank you for being with us and thank you for being with our audience. I'm so pleased to have you here today.
Thank you so much for asking me to come, Les. It's nice to meet you. I know your work too, and I'm really glad to have this time with you. Thanks.
Good. Thank you so much. Now, I'm wanting to talk with you today about, I guess this is your latest book, isn't it? Fierce Yes. Love. What an incredible resource this book is. And first, before we get into that, let's get into a little credential here, although this may take a while. I'm going to give the reduced version of it.
Let's not.
You've been around quite a bit, haven't you? You're now the senior minister, right, at the Multicultural Middle Church in Manhattan. And one of the things you say on there is it's a multi-ethnic rainbow coalition of love, justice, and worship that rocks your soul.
That's right. That.
Okay. And you've been featured on
all kinds of public things. Yeah.
All of the major TV outlets and written news outlets. And you've been on tour with a variety of speakers, and you've also been out with Alicia Keys. Can you feel that envy coming out now for me?
Yes.
You're married to John, right. And you have a son and daughter-in-law, and most importantly, a little grandchild. And so that's the most important thing of all there. Author of multiple books and speaker, community leader and activist, and MDiv from Princeton, PhD in psychology and religion from Drew University. So your credentials are quite impressive there. I want to focus on your book, Fierce Love.
Yeah.
And that title, when I first saw it and heard it, just gripped me. Tell me about, first of all, how you came up with the title, Fierce Love. Yeah. And what prompted you to write this book in the first place?
Thank you. I would say being a revolutionary lover might be my most powerful credential. I'm the oldest child in a family of five, and we got reconnected with an older brother, so now there's six of us. I function oldest child, I comadre the younger kids. I love deep and hard. And quite frankly, Les, I've been a Christian since I was in my mother's womb, but religion had become for me so unbelievably far from the religion of Jesus, who I consider my mentor, far away from the world's religions, Les, that almost all say, something about neighbor love, about connecting and caring for one another. And I started thinking, like, what happened? How did this love thing get to be so much more about judgment and leaving people out and hurting people and wounding people and, you know, even killing people in the name of religion? And I was kind of wrestling with that in my psych program, my studies. Could we have a better God? Could we think about a more grown-up God, a more compassionate God? Because we create God a bit, right? God is, but we also create a little bit of the God we love. And I realized that God wasn't the most important part of what I was wrestling with. I was really wanting to get to what I think predates religion, this idea of Ubuntu, this idea of I am who I am because you are who you are. I cannot survive unless you survive. Dr. King would have said, I can't be fully who I am till you're fully who you are. And so that's about love. And I think that kind of love is fierce, like fierce and fearless and sacrificial and willing to lay down. Jesus would have said your life for the other, but I would say lay down your stuff, you know, lay down what blocks you from the other person, lay down your self-interest and find a shared self-interest. So I wrote this book, Fierce Love, as COVID was happening around the globe and as my church burned down, and nothing proved more to me how important fierce love is to the survival of the planet than these last 3 years. So that's what it's all about. It's a calling in to do better together.
One of the things that you are passionate about is to make sure that even though you draw from your own Christian tradition, that there's a very deep respect toward individuals who may have a very different religious background or none whatsoever. And absolutely. So, in fact, you mentioned this just very briefly. I ran across a study a while back about, you know, what is it about people in the church? If you could describe people in the church with one word, what would that word be? And to no one's surprise, the answer is judgment. And so to your, and what I'm hearing you say is, well, if we could describe people who are religiously oriented, what would that one word be?
I would love for it to be lovers.
Love.
I'd love for it to be that. You know, you and I both have this psych background, and, you know, in the Myers-Briggs talk, let's say the people who care about justice are right in the same place as judgment. We want a just world, right? We want a whole world. We want a peaceful world. We want a world in which everyone has enough, in which, you know, justice rolls down like waters, if you will, and righteousness like a mighty stream. But sadly, I think fear increases tribalism, and fear increases scarcity mentality. Fear exacerbates narcissism. And we end up really using religion as a tool to put borders around ourselves, boundaries around ourselves, and leave people out as opposed to calling people in. So I wish religion, Brian McLaren taught me actually, that the roots of the word religion is religio, which is to rebind, to relegate, to bind ourselves together. What if religion bound us to each other? And whether we were atheists, agnostics, Unitarians, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, people, humans on the planet, bound together by love.
Might we first start with the notion that says, before anything, may I love you? And may I know who you are so that I can love you more cleanly, more purely. And by the way, I'd be more than happy for you to know who I am.
Exactly.
One of the things that struck me most about your approach toward love is, and you use the word narcissism right now, it's so much of an anti-narcissistic way of thinking. In fact, in one of my earlier videos, I came up with what I call a new way of defining narcissism. Mm-hmm. And the new way of defining narcissism is it's an absence of love. Narcissists are so completely enamored with themselves. They're so full of their own importance and entitlement and superiority. They have no particular need or reason to know who you are and empathize. And so here you're one of the ones that says, well, I'm breaking through that shield. And we're not going to do it. We want to be far more inclusive than that. And I love that as your starting point. Okay, you came up with a quote in your book about love. Yes. And you said that your favorite quote about love is, and I can't remember who the man was that you were quoting, that it's a non-possessive delight in the particularity of the other.
Yeah.
Could you please elaborate on it? Wow. Such a wonderful phrase. The non-possessive delight in the particularity of the other. What does that say to you?
Oh my gosh, it says everything. You know, funny quick story. I went to seminary at Princeton, and it's my professor, Jim Loader, who that's his quote.
Okay.
But I had it wrong for a minute. I thought it was Diogenes Allen. And so I was looking for it and looking for it. And I said it so much, when I Googled that quote, it would come up as me.
Okay.
I did some digging. I'm like, a tribute.
Yeah.
It was one of my favorite professors, Jim Loader, a non-possessive delight. Not can I force my will on you. Not can I change you. Not do you provide something for me, a hole in my soul that you fill, which I think narcissism is pretty much about a hole in the soul, but more like I'm just curious about you. I'm just discovering you. You're unfolding for me like a story. And I just want to see what it is and know what it is and smile at your quirks and delight in your uniqueness and vibe with your energy and be fulfilled just because you're on the planet. And I think that is like a what I would call a holy curiosity, a double entendre, holy meaning sacred maybe, but also holy as a whole curiosity, just a mom and a dad looking at the baby and going, look at those toes. Wow, look at that smile. Look at this baby learning how to toddle. Look at the first language. That kind of becoming that gives us wonder. What if we could have less that kind of wonder about each other, about our neighbor, about the culture of the other, about the stories of the other? This is what I think love is.
Okay, now having read your Fierce Love book, I know that you didn't necessarily come to this kind of position at age 20.
That's correct.
it's been a journey for you.
Yes, it is.
And yes, it is. Part of it has some family of origin issues. Part of it has to do with the culture you grew in, you being a person of color in a world that didn't know necessarily what to do with you. And then through some of your highs and lows. And by the way, you've not always been in the formal ministry. You've started out in the world of business for a number of years. So what is it about your early life that now looking back upon you can see was priming you to go towards this direction that you've taken your life?
Yeah, I'm raised by two Black parents from Mississippi who grew up in the time of Jim Crow. And if you read my book, Friends, you'll see like they are not perfect people. But at some of the most critical times in my life, they loved me with such, perfection. Called the N-word for the first time. And my dad goes to the Air Force Base commander and demands reparations, demands an apology. And he tells the truth about it. So I get really clear that being truthful in our stories is about love. My mom says, Jackie, it's silly that someone won't love you because you're Black. What? Silly. So she kind of poo-poos racial prejudice, right? Which means she poo-poos prejudice, period. My mother, who would take soup to everybody who's sick. And she took me to prayer. So there was a way in which, before I knew King's work, which I do now, or John Lewis's work, or Rabbi Heschel's work, my parents were kind of teaching me that love and justice were twins or two sides of a coin. And they were teaching me that I was loved by a holy other, God, and by these imperfect humans. So there was a kind of like dance between my faith life and my home life. We played a lot. We laughed a lot. We had a lot of joy. We cooked a lot. We fought it out. We duked it out, you know, with our words a lot too. So the kind of chaotic, messy, beautiful thing that love is what I think my parents gave me. And therefore, not a whole bunch of judgment, a kind of okay, let me see that unfold, which I think is the way we're like God. Like we could be creative and watch things unfold.
Do you remember as a kid that you were already thinking in the direction that you are now, but just in a much more primary kind of way? Would that be a good way to put it?
Absolutely. I was deeply in love with my siblings and my folks. And I was like Sunday school teacher when I was 8 and singing in the choir. So there was a kind of primordial, almost like a, I would say as soon as I could talk, my sister was born 21 months after me. And my mom told me I was straightening up the couch cushions and cleaning up and anticipating of her coming home from the hospital.
Yeah.
So I was ready to love
her.
I was ready to love her when
All
I was
right.
2.
It's time to get the show on the road here.
That's right. That's right.
Jackie, I'm going to share with you a personal story. I don't know if I've ever even told anybody this. I guess I have a twin brother, Lee. And my brother and I were at my grandfather's house. And I'm just going to say it. I don't think that I ever had a time at his house. He had a little two-bedroom house on the outskirts of Atlanta where I mostly grew up. I don't think I ever had a time where I was at his house where he didn't use the N-word multiple times.
Oh.
And my mother would just give me hard lectures on the way home every time. It's like, don't you ever let me hear you
don't
talk
you ever
like
let
that.
Me hear you. Yeah.
And at age 6, my brother was talking about a friend of his at school, and his name was Willie. And my grandfather asked him, is that boy a N-word? And my brother, I don't know that it even registered to even ask, think about that. It was like, well, I guess. And he went on and lectured him about how you can't do that. You can't be with someone like that. And I remember, and my brother as well, I remember at age 6 thinking something is really, really wrong here. I mean, and at age 6, I was smart enough to see that. And one of the things that I find is that people, and I didn't mean to just completely go off into racism here, but people.
I think
who,
it's okay. Yeah.
Well, yeah. People who think that way are literally, they're stuck in childhood irrationality. I was a 6-year-old kid and knew better than that.
Yeah.
And I'm continually astonished at how people, when they hear someone like you, and I know that some folks, they find out, she's a minister, she's a Christian, she's in the church, she must be that judgmental kind of person that we mentioned. How so many people quickly have to go into stereotypes and binary black and white thinking. And so when I hear you talking about love and then your wonderful quote or that you borrowed, the non-possessive delight in the particularity of the other, I'm assuming that's something that you began, you didn't articulate it as a little kid quite that accurate, quite that well. But as an adult, I'm sure there must have been many experiences that you had that made you think, you know, we can do better. We can be better.
Absolutely. I tell a story in my book, Fierce Love, about, I'm going to call it the Good Canadian story really quickly.
Okay.
I had a car accident when I was about 22 years old, relatively fresh out of college in Canada on the QEW, flipped my car over. I mean, flipped.
Yeah, that's
my
in your book. Yeah.
On the highway. And there I was in the hospital lobby crying my eyes out. And this Canadian lady like walks across the, you know, the lobby to me, crosses borders to get to me, literally, right? Across the room. We're not alike. I'm a black girl with an afro full of glass and blood on my jacket. She took me to a drugstore. She took me to a hotel. She paid the bill. She took me to
get that's literally the Good Samaritan story.
Literally, literally the story. So that, and it's not the only thing, right? Like I've watched relationships between Muslims and Jews, and I've watched relationships between Blacks and whites and Hispanics and Asians and, you know, strangers. We will grab someone from the street corner and pull them before they get hit by a car, or we'll dive into the fire and save each other. We'll wade into the fetid waters after a storm. We know what this looks like. We know what this looks like. And disaster isn't the only time we know. I think we forget it. We forget it when we're afraid. We forget it when the resources feel scarce. We forget it in times of war And we're at war right now. I'm going to say out loud, we are having an ideological war, not just in our nation, but around the globe, about what kind of people we want to be.
Who can be in and who's out, who's lovable, who's not.
Exactly. Who deserves a good life?
Yeah.
Who deserves fairness? Who deserves healthcare? And honestly, I'm frightened in some ways about the course we're on. And I'm convinced that love is the only thing to stop this kind of hatred and bigotry.
I'd like for you to be aware of my video courses. One of them is entitled Free to Be, Finding Yourself Despite the Controllers in Your Life. Now, inside this course are various modules, and inside each module, it breaks down into various lessons with a video, teaching documents, and then also questions that go along with it. For example, inside Free to Be, you'll learn how controllers want to invite you into their games, but then you'll also learn about the 7 principles of freedom, how to develop self-trust, and much more. Now, if you are interested in enrolling in the classes, you could go to our survivingnarcissism.tv website, click the link for courses, and you'll find that one and others. And I hope that you would find them to be quite therapeutic.
And now back to Surviving Narcissism with Dr. Carter.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that just as hatred has to be taught, it just doesn't arise out of nowhere. Love has to be taught.
Yes.
Now, in your book, you have what do you call them? Affirmations or let's see here. What do you refer to them as?
I think I say affirmations. Yeah.
Okay. The 9 affirmations, is that what they are? Yeah. About understanding the nature of love, mm-hmm. and the first thing that you mention is that in order for us to love properly, we have to learn how to love ourselves.
That's right.
And sometimes we have to unlearn some of the, what I was had in my childhood and some of the what you learned in your childhood. We have to unlearn some of it and then relearn is all over again. But it begins with learning to love yourself.
That's right. That's right. And so 9, kind of 9 spiritual practices, right? I do 9 chapters, 3 on self, 3 on people, your posse, your family, and 3 on the world. Love your neighbor as yourself. And the Greek, that's an equal sign. Those clauses are the same. How actually can we really love someone if we don't appreciate the foibles, the quirkiness, the strangeness, the beauty, the kindness, the growing edges of ourselves? That's about truth. And this again, your work on narcissism, right? Like you can look in a mirror or you can look in a pool like narcissists did and see reflected something that's not true. The truth is you and I are flawed, beautiful, scarred, healing, powerful, vulnerable creatures. And that self-love is the practice ground for loving the other, the otherness of the other, to except when I'm broken.
You can't give away something that you don't possess within yourself.
Cannot. You can like them. You can have an infatuation. You can even be sexually drawn to them. But to love someone, I think it starts with a powerful love of self.
Right. You actually mentioned an illustration in your book about you were exposed to a high school teacher.
Yes.
And the way you put it is you were hazed by that teacher. And then later you learned, and perhaps it was from this very teacher, that she herself had been on the receiving end of a great deal of hate and strain. But instead of coming to terms with that and going towards the better alternative, she just perpetuated what was given to her.
Right.
And that's one of the most unfortunate themes that I have picked up on, obviously, as a therapist. There's a friend of mine who's since died. He wrote a book called Kids Who Carry Our Pain.
Mm-hmm.
And it just right there, that simple title says so much. So many people are carrying pain from their own difficult circumstances, whether it's from their deep past or in some of their adult situations, and they've not come to terms with it. And so what they do is they displace their pain onto other individuals. They project their pain into other individuals. Why do you suppose it happens that way? What's your take on, you know, what the dynamic is there?
I think it's fundamentally we do what we know, right? And hurt people hurt people. I mean, the very best thing that I is about myself are things that I learned from my parents, right? Like I learned from my parents really important things. But I also watched and learned things that some of which I had to unlearn, is what you say. So if we don't pay attention, if we're not honest, or like say have a critical practice of self-examination, therapy, coaching, journaling, whatever, to say, wow, look at this thing right here and look at where it comes from, then it just stays inside us. So that I think is it's very simple that we are raised in containers, in environments, and those environments teach us what it is to parent, to love, to be a partner, and the good stuff stays there. And if we don't critically examine it, so also does the unfortunate stuff. Really quick story of how I think it can be better is we have to also be willing to be brave enough to tell people the things that hurt us. So my dad is 88 years old, and he's still learning. And my dad, read my book, y'all, you know, had some things to unlearn. He was raised in a container that was tough, rough, love was hard, you know, discipline was violent. So he who loves us ridiculously also brought this is how you parent in ways that were not fun and joyful all the time. So a few weeks ago, you know, he's not feeling well, he's sick, he's wrestling with some things. And a bunch of the kids, almost all of us were home. And we were like, just kind of saying like, Dad, here's what we need. So my 88-year-old dad put himself in a place of vulnerability for his adult children to say, here's what could be better. What if we talked this way? What if we didn't use this kind of language, right? What if we gave each other more? I mean, I couldn't believe it.
And that's a contrast to what I know you grew up in based on what you say in the book. So in other words, here he is at 88 saying, well, I'll learn.
And he said it at 45, and he said it at 65. So the children also raise the parent is what I'm trying to say less. The families teach each other if we can create a context in which that's safe to do. And my dad has given us a chance over time to be partners with him in creating the relationships that we all want.
Well, that's your influence, I'm sure, and plenty of other folks, I imagine. Yeah. What would you say to the person that says, well, I'm really hearing you, what you say registers with me, Dr. Lewis, but I have this person or these people or that group that would never in 100 years buy into what you're saying. I've tried my best to talk about, you know, different ways of thinking and being, and these people just shut me down. What are we going to do with that person that says, I'm stuck with these individuals? I don't know how to, even though I'm trying to go in the right direction.
Yeah. I think the hardest thing in the world is to just admit, and you do this as a therapist, me as a clergy, sometimes it's not going to work. Sometimes that dynamic isn't going to change. It's not going to get better. You're not wanted. You got to know when to say that's enough. And so I want to say that as kindly as I can, that part of loving ourselves is to also know when we've reached the end of our ability to cope in that situation, or the end of our rope, or the end of our time, and to be able to kind of make a good goodbye. This does not work for me, and I can't. That's not a surrender. That's actually, I think, a gift to give you and the relationship. Sometimes things are finished, and maybe it's helpful to know what time that is as well.
One of my books is entitled "When Pleasing You Is Killing Me."
Ah, yes.
And the notion is, okay, I'm really trying hard to be a nice person here, empathy and goodness and active listening and all that, but it's wearing me out. And so I guess what you're saying is there's some folks that will hear what you have to say, or I have to say, or our audience who are really leaning into this, they'll say, well, everything you're saying is just a crock. It doesn't make sense to me. But I guess what I'm hearing you also say is, that's where they are.
Yep.
And sometimes there's just not a whole lot I can do to make it any different than what it actually is, and let them be. And that can be difficult because it means that you withdraw emotionally and intellectually at times from those individuals, not because you want to, but it's part of your own self-love. I've got to protect myself. I mean, would that be a fair thing for us to say?
I do. I think it's a fair thing to say. I think a relationship requires two people, or, you know, at least. And that's not true. You and I would say there's relationships inside the folks inside ourselves, right? But in this moment, we're talking about interpersonal relationships, requires mutuality and requires respect and requires both folks to want to be in it. So one, you hear this and it doesn't work for you. That's okay. But do find the thing that does work for you to have a flourishing life. What's the wisdom that you need to make peace with yourself, to love yourself? What's the wisdom you need to be in good relationship with the people in your life, to not have them plugging your holes like a piece of Swiss cheese, but for them to partner with you? And what's the relationship you need to have with the universe, like, right, the environment, with the sense of wonder, of joy, of delight, curate it in your own way, in your own time, because you deserve all of that goodness for yourself.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, are you an outdoors person?
I like it. I love an ocean. Give me a river. Give me an ocean. Give me some water. I want to be in it.
Okay. All right. In our home, you mentioned before we went on the air, we have art. My wife is a classically trained musician. We love music. We love to be outdoors. So I just think that we can connect with goodness and decency through so many different ways. But okay, I want to dive in here with this one. In one of your practices, you say that we should confront others boldly and transform your circumstances with moral courage. And so when I ask the question, what if people say, well, who you are and what you think is just no good as far as I'm concerned, what you're saying is let's hold on to your moral courage. Don't let others just gaslight you out of your position. Yeah. Know that when you focus in on the centrality of love, I can't do any better than that. And so
can't do any better. And, you know, look, we're having a 30-minute conversation about giant universal big concepts.
Yeah.
Right. But I think the most important thing that I want to say is you've got to find, friends, a compass for yourself. Mm-hmm. Mine is love. What my question is, what would love have me do? And that makes me brave and bold and feisty sometimes. It makes me tender and quiet and vulnerable sometimes. Sometimes it makes me lead with my hands in the air, with standing up for justice. Sometimes it makes me go sit in a hospital room with someone who I know has COVID and wear two masks and try to pray for them. Love is my compass. What's yours, friends? I hope that it is something that nurtures you. And I'm recommending love.
Another one of the things that you mentioned in your book is that we need to learn how to think inclusively.
Yes.
And as opposed to exclusive. You're in the club, you're not in the club.
Like the whole human race is your tribe, right? If you think that, you know, times of scarcity and fear make us tribal, well, how about if the whole human race is your tribe? How about if Palestinians and Israelis are each other's tribe? Because they are. How about if all of us acknowledge that we come from the cradle of civilization, which is called Africa? Hello, everybody who's African. So what if that black kid on the corner with his pants down is in your tribe? What about that? What about that? What about if the Chinese auntie is your auntie? How about that? That would make a difference in the way we live our lives.
I bet you give some pretty good sermons, don't you?
Oh, yeah. Middlechurch.org, y'all, if you want to hear some good preaching.
Oh, I could listen to this all day long now. One of the things that you talk about, and this comes from your own African-American heritage, is the power of Ubuntu. Am I saying that correctly?
That's exactly right.
Would you please explain that to us?
I will. And then I'm getting a ping about my husband's medicine. My husband just had surgery.
Okay.
Here's what Ubuntu is. It is it predates religion because it comes from that place in Africa, in the sub-Saharan African places where the Zulu people say Ubuntu Ngubuntu Ngubuntu, which means a human is a human through other humans. I am not a human by myself. There's no solo human. It's a plural. I'm a human through other humans. I am who I am because you are who you are. To quote that movie, Jerry Maguire, you complete me. My self-interest and your self-interest are the same. So this idea is grounds human religion, but grounds human relating. It grounds human functioning. Businesses study Ubuntu because it is about how we're all going to be a team flourishing together. My hope on our journey is we understand the whole human race is one organism pulsing toward tomorrow together. Your finger is that Chinese lady on the street, and your heart is that young, hungry child in Appalachia, and your mind is the Black kid learning how to code. We're all connected.
Dr. Jackie Lewis, we could go on and on here. I'm so glad that you've taken the time out of your day. And I know you have a lot going on a personal level there with your husband and having been in surgery. You put so much into this book, Fierce Love. And all I can say is to our audience, please go get the book. You'll be glad you did. And you tell your story so eloquently in there and how you've arrived at these various principles that you're talking about. Any final parting words that you want to share with us as we ponder, you know, where we're going from here, especially knowing that there are plenty of other individuals who just don't understand in the least what you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So, Celeste, thank you, first of all, for this time. I don't take for granted an opportunity to speak in new places. As we're doing this, it's February. So that's a month of love. It's also Black History Month. And as we do this, we just have watched crazy violence in Chinese communities right around Lunar New Year. Every day, in every way, there is going to be someone in the world, someone in your life who because they're wounded or their soul has a hole in it, can be unkind, mean, violent. The only thing that changes hatred and violence is love. So love yourself as a powerful place to start. Then find a way to delight in your family, friends, the people around you, your aging dad, your recently surgeried husband, your kiddos, your baby mama, whoever all it is, and look at them as a kind of a delight to enjoy and behold. And that kind of thing will have ripples in the world. It'll make you think of the Palestinian woman in Afghanistan standing up for herself as your sister. And this, I think, is the aim of human flourishing.
Well, I so appreciate your message. Dr. Jackie Lewis, thank you for spending the time here today with us. It's such an honor to have someone of your stature to join us. And I wish you the very best. And Team Healthy, okay, you've heard it here from somebody who's been there, done that, and has worked her way to the where she's able to articulate this as well as she has. So let's emulate what Dr. Lewis is telling us. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Team Healthy. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. We are so glad to have you on Team Healthy.